They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What a bushel of corn says about the American economy. An attitude check from the good people at Gallup on the broadcast today. And also, it's the middle class, stupid, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Thursday, the 12th of July. Good to have you with us. And do this for me as we get going today, would you? Forget about Europe and the stock market and the LIBOR and the price of a barrel of crude. And consider instead corn and the future of the American economy. At the Mercantile Exchange in Chicago today, traders looked at the weather forecast for the Midwest. Not a whole lot of rain coming, apparently. And they promptly sent corn prices up another 3% on top of its recent rise. Marketplace's Sally Herships has the farm report today.
Not to be too corny, but corn really drives our economy. From cereal to animal feed to the gas in your tank, which is about 10% ethanol and made from corn.
I think the misnomer is that we are a gas economy or an information economy. If you want to really get right down to it, we're almost a corn economy.
Tom Perko is president of Bevmark, a food and beverage consulting company. He says as corn prices go up, consumers can expect to pay more, from the obvious, soda made with corn syrup, to the disposable cup you drink it in, even to your toothpaste. Corn is also a feed for our food.
Tell me how many cattle you have.
My mom's kind of like asking how much money we've got, but we run tens of thousands in a year.
Pete Bonds is with the Bonds Ranch in Saginaw, Texas. The drought hit his herd hard last year.
It just flat forgot to rain.
So Bonds Ranch had to sell off 50% of its cattle. That's what other ranchers are facing now. No grass and skyrocketing corn prices. William Tierney is chief economist at Ag Resources, a market advisory firm.
You can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, and you go, I'm going to cut my losses now before they lose weight, before they lose condition.
Which means one silverish lining for steak lovers. The price of corn may be going up, but the price of beef is coming down. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
For every headline economic indicator that we get, there is always slightly more interesting stuff to be had by reading deeper into the numbers. And the example of choice today is unemployment. 8.2%, of course, is the familiar number. You dig down, though, and you see joblessness for teenagers last month was 23.7%. Competition is tough even for those typical summer jobs, it turns out. But a report this week shows a little relief down there at the bottom of the job spectrum. Marketplace's Eve Troeh has that story.
In Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 15-year-old Destiny Raber says all her friends want jobs. Most apply to Kennywood, the local amusement park. But it's hard to get in, and newcomers do the dirty work.
Starting, you're like just sweeping up stuff and cleaning up puke and all that, and that does not sound amusing.
Destiny's feeling lucky. She just landed a job through a special program that hires teens at a medical center.
It'll be food service at a retirement home. $7.93 an hour.
Only 2 hours a day, but good for her resume.
Yeah, I want to be a doctor when I grow up, so it's a good start.
In Los Angeles, 18-year-old Miriam Matthew has worked as a part-time office assistant for 2 years. That started as a summer job.
It kind of evolved into something more, and now it's part of my daily life.
Now that she's in junior college,
I use a lot of my money towards books. Different fees come up all the time.
With college costs rising or parents still out of work, paid jobs are crucial for many teens. Job placement executive John Challenger sees more companies hiring teens now than the past 5 years. That's good news for older workers, too. It means they might be finding real jobs, not just summer jobs, especially 20-somethings.
Some of them now seem to be finding the kind of employment they're looking for coming out of college, the 20 to 24-year-old.
Instead of resorting back to the amusement park or lifeguard station with a bachelor's degree in hand, I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, another tepid session, you might call it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's been a good long while since James Carville helped Bill Clinton win the presidency, and this country has changed plenty since 1992. But if you stick around politics long enough, things do start to repeat themselves. Carville is looking ahead now to this November, talking about the same themes he was 20 years ago. He's out with a new book. It's called It's the Middle Class, Stupid. He co-wrote it with Democratic pollster Stan Greenberg. James, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
All right, so I'll tell you what. I'm going to pick up with the title of this thing. You call it It's the Middle Class, Stupid. It's a riff, of course, on It's the Economy, Stupid from the Clinton campaign in 92. And yet here we are 20 years later, and you're still trying to gin up a conversation about the middle class. And you say this in the book. You guys failed, right?
We feel like the middle class has not been an integral part of the conversation in American politics and American policy, for that matter.
Why hasn't it been, though? I mean, you guys have been trying for a long time.
It's a good question. There are a lot of powerful people that don't want it to be. If you're dependent on low-wage workers, you don't want the middle class to be part of this. If you're the kind of person that you want corporate profits to go to people other than workers, you don't want the middle class to be part of this.
But is it a corporation's job to help the middle class, or is it a corporation's job to help its shareholders?
Well, it's a corporate job to help its shareholders, and it's my job to help the middle class. That's why I'm writing a book.
Fair enough.
Somebody's got to point out what's happening. We hear personal stories about how their lives have been wrecked.
I wonder how much of the Democrats' problems this election cycle and in the past couple of years has been that a big chunk of the middle class, right, middle class, blue-collar workers in right. the central part of the country have decided to vote for the other guy.
Well, I don't know. They haven't decided yet.
Well, they decided in 2010 pretty hard, James.
Yeah, well, they're a little bit different electorate in 2010, and they had reasons behind it. I actually think, you know, people moan about the Democrats' problems. I would point out that from 1968 to 1988, the Republicans lost a popular vote one time. From 92 to 2008, the Democrats have lost a popular vote one
time.
Do
you actually think that both the candidates this time are not talking to the middle class? Do you think they're—
I actually think that President Obama's done much better. I mean, I was always going to be for the president, but I would describe myself as much more enthusiastic today than I was 6 weeks ago.
And Governor Romney, I'm going to guess you say he's not talking to the middle class at all.
Try to get Romney and middle class in the same sentence. I mean,
here's the thing, though, right? I mean, you can look at Mitt Romney and you can look at him and you say he's not the middle class guy, but he's talking the talk. He's going out there and he's trying to sell his program to the middle class.
What programs is he selling to the middle class? Everything. His program to the middle class is, I'll do everything that Bush did. I'll just do more of it.
Yeah, but he's going out to the middle of the country. He's going out to Iowa and talking to farmers. He's going to Atlanta and manufacturing plants.
What do you expect him to do?
Well, that's talking to the middle class.
But he's not saying what's his message to these people? Romney wants to repeal Dodd-Frank. Do you think that's good for middle class people?
How much of the problem that the presidents have are because he has been trying to tell a story of the national economy growing, which it is, we have to say, but people's personal economies are still stuck 4 years ago?
A lot of it. You hit on the thing. And that's the reason that I'm beginning to like this campaign better. Look forward. Don't look back. That's the key to this election, we think, from the vantage point of the president, if you will.
Far be it for me to accuse a political strategist of being cynical, but the middle class in this country votes. Are you writing this to maybe get that vote
hope,
out there?
I hope so. What do you think I'm doing here? Guilty.
James Carville, his book with Stan Greenberg is called It's the Middle Class. Stupid. James, thanks a lot.
You bet. Appreciate it.
Monday on the broadcast, the other side of the aisle, Mike Huckabee and how he thinks the candidates are doing talking to the middle class and everybody else as well. We had economist Stephen Levitt on the show earlier this week. The Freakonomics of parenting, if you will.
When I was a kid, my parents bribed me. It was just a mainstay of our household is that if I did well in school, they'd give me $50 maybe for every day.
No, get out of here. $50? I was not the only one amazed, let me tell you. Here's a bit of how some of you responded on our Twitter and our Facebook feeds.
Sure, if you want to teach your children that an education is all about making money, which apparently is what almost everyone believes now.
Do I do my job because it makes me feel good to contribute to society or some bogus idea like that? No, I do my job because I get paid. So yes, my parents bribed me, just like my employer bribes me. Nothing wrong with that.
To the dude who talked about paying kids for grades, please adopt mine because he's already costing me a fortune.
You know how to reach us or bribe us. No, I'm just kidding. Twitter is at Marketplace APM. You can get me at Kai Rizdahl. Coming up, tax the rich, so long as it's not us.
Most of us want to think of ourselves, no matter how much we make, as middle class or working class. Those are the two big labels.
Gallup and an attitude check. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, you go ahead and make it six straight losses for the Dow Industrials if you're keeping track. It sank another 31 points today, a quarter of 1%. The closing number, 12,573. The NASDAQ dropped 21 points, 0.75%, 2866. The S&P 500. Why, it carved off 6 points, 0.5%, 1334 was the ending point there. Shares of Super Value lost nearly half their value on a dismal earnings report. The 49% plunge came after the operator of Jewel Osco, Albertsons, and other supermarkets said it's considering a sale of all or part of that company. Shares of Safeway down 12% today. Stock in Kroger lost nearly 4% on this Thursday. Bond prices rose. That pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.47%. Holy cannolis, man. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday the 13th. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for June. How are we feeling about the economy? The University of Michigan issues its preliminary July consumer sentiment survey. And in the galaxy, not so far away, actor Harrison Ford turns 70. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome back. It's been, years now that Europe and the United States have been imposing economic sanctions on Iran over its nuclear program without a whole lot of impact, mostly because Iran has had so much crude oil to sell. Now, though, the European Union has come up with a free market approach, sort of. No more insurance for the tankers that carry Iranian oil, which actually might be working out. Julian Bray covers the shipping industries from London, England. Julian, good to have you with us.
And good to be here as well.
Is it as simple as the European Union saying you can't buy Iranian oil, or are they using another mechanism, another enforcement mechanism?
Well, the enforcement mechanism is very, very simple. What they're doing, they say, we won't insure you. And so what actually happens is, as most of the insurance is carried out in London, it is a very easy bar to put in place, because quite simply, if a tanker goes into a port and it hasn't got insurance, then, of course, it will be seized. So what has happened is that Tehran has also decided to go into the insurance market. So there are other ways of doing these things. And of course, you can also re-flag ships, which means instead of having your own flag on it, you put a flag of convenience, and therefore your ship, say, becomes part of the state of Moldavia or something like that.
Yeah. I thought Moldavia was landlocked, no?
Well, no reason why they can't have a shipping line.
That's right. This does present the Iranians a problem, right? Because they are pumping all this oil, they can only sell part of it, and they have to put it someplace.
Well, what they're doing, of course, is that if they're not sticking it into spare tankers, they're actually cutting back production. Mm. Now, the problem in the UK, of course, is that we're an island and we're actually a very cold little country. And so we do actually need the heating during the winter, or this year we need it in the summer as well. So it is going to affect our oil prices, and it's going to affect the price of every available good and services, that we buy.
Right, in the global economy. Does this insurance mechanism that the EU is using, does it lend itself to cheating, I guess is the word, right? I mean, there's got to be all kinds of ways that...
Well, let's put it like this, sort of creative accounting.
And we know how well that turned out.
Yeah, it's a little bit like Barclays in a spartial way, you might say. You don't actually have to pay in cash. So they will actually say, well, we'll come to a barter arrangement, or it might be an offset arrangement through a third country, which, of course, is a form of cheating. But the whole point is, will they get the oil? And so if they, shall we say, they get it to the neighbouring country, right, then it's a short trip over the border. And also, I did hear that some people are actually refitting standard shipping containers and putting a kind of vinyl liner inside, and actually putting the crude inside shipping containers. Now, that's very, very crafty.
That's great. That's great. And what could possibly go wrong with a vinyl liner inside a big steel shipping container? Julian Bray in London. Julian, thanks very much.
Thank you.
I was out in Montana last week working on a television thing, and I saw something way up in the northeast corner of that state that I haven't seen in years. It was a payphone, the once ubiquitous fixture that is not ubiquitous anymore. In 1999, there were more than 2 million payphones in this country. Today, less than 500,000. But they are not all going the way of the buggy whip. New York City started an experiment this week to turn some of its phone booths into free Wi-Fi hotspots, if you can appreciate the irony there. We sent Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith to check it out.
There are 12,000 payphones in New York City. 10 of them have been outfitted with a Wi-Fi antenna, so passersby can get online for free. A company called Van Wagner owns about a third of New York's payphones. Executive Peter Izzo says it costs $2,000 to convert a payphone into a Wi-Fi hotspot, but it's worth it to breathe new life into a dying product.
Just by watching the people in the street as they all walk with their heads down with their telephones, we decided to leverage the infrastructure that took us 10 years to build at a cost of $7 million, and bring bandwidth to the street corner.
And revenue to Van Wagner, says Izzo. Log on, you might see an ad. Buy something, Van Wagner might get a cut. But why not just get rid of the actual phones?
It's a really, really good question.
Raul Merchant is Chief Information and Innovation Officer for the City of New York. He says payphones still provide an important service to visitors and residents.
It would be unfair, especially the tourists. And a lot of our citizens can get an access to a phone.
I checked out a Wi-Fi hotspot in Midtown Manhattan.
NYC public Wi-Fi.
And I'm on. The Wi-Fi worked like a charm. Using the actual phone was a little trickier.
It ate my quarter. Oh my God, it ate my quarter. Oh.
Actually, it ate three of my quarters, but I did get to use the free Wi-Fi, so it probably evens out in the end.
In New York, at the corner of 48th and Madison, on a payphone, this is Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
An interesting item crossed our desks here this morning in the how much people work and how much they get paid for it department. It was a memo from a union president telling his members, quote, you have to file for every dime the contract says the company owes you, unquote. Basically, don't work a minute more than 40 hours without getting paid for it. We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to find out whether people not getting paid for overtime is a trend in this post-recession economy.
there definitely is a trend. More federal lawsuits filed over alleged wage and hour violations. 30% more since 2008, almost four times as many since 2000. Barry Miller is a partner at the law firm Seiforth Shaw that crunched the numbers. They represent employers.
And certainly the economy plays into that because you have a lot more people who are out of work. And the longer it takes somebody to find a new job, the more likely they are to sue.
Kathy Ruckelshaus is legal director at the National Employment Law Project, which advocates for employees. She thinks there are more violations now. Managers pressuring workers to put in extra time off the clock to finish up jobs and increase productivity.
Workers sort of grinning and bearing it. It's always hard for workers who are still working at an employer to come forward and complain or even to ask about pay discrepancies or long hours because they fear losing their jobs.
Southern California warehouse worker David Acosta is a plaintiff in a class action lawsuit alleging wage theft and failure to pay overtime. He says he and fellow workers were paid at minimum wage or below and never got overtime, even when the warehouse was busy and they worked from 6 a.m. to 9 or 10 at night. We reached him at home on his day off.
I mostly did it because of my family. We also had this fear where if we complained, we would often see the repercussions where our paychecks would actually be short.
We did not receive a response to the allegations in this lawsuit from the warehouse companies by our deadline. Employment lawyer Barry Miller notes that wage and hour lawsuits are up in both federal and state courts, especially in California, New York, and Massachusetts. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Tax the rich. Don't tax anybody. It'll hurt the economy. The economy won't care. That, in four short sentences, is the essence of the presidential campaign so far this week. President Obama held a high-profile event to make his desires for the Bush tax cuts clear. Governor Romney has been responding in kind. Not much discussed, though, is what Americans actually think about the whole thing.
And the latest poll numbers suggest
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport, the editor-in-chief at Gallup, is here once again for a segment that we call Attitude Check. Hey, Frank, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Kai.
So taxes. The president, as you know, made the big tax pitch earlier this week. It is the theme, I guess, of the campaign this week. Here's the thing, though. How do taxes play in Peoria?
You know, that's an interesting question. The idea of increased taxes on the rich, however you define it, plays very well with the average American, most of whom don't make that much, so they say, sure, why not? I don't think, however, that taxes per se are the key issue for Americans now. That is, how are you going to fix the economy and how are you going to create more jobs?
Can you specify, are they 10th, are they 20th, are they 349th on the list? Do we know?
347th, not 349.
Right. A lot of this probably is self-identification, right? If you perceive yourself to be middle class or lower middle class, you think one way and upper middle class another way?
That's right. Although I have to say very few Americans claim the label Kai upper class or rich. Most of us want to think of ourselves, no matter how much we make, as middle class or working class. Those are the two big labels. But absolutely, your view on raising taxes, even for the rich, is related to your socioeconomic status. And of course, it's highly political.
My guess would be, and this is a rare instance of me guessing the answer to a question before I actually ask it. Do Americans think they are taxed too much right now?
Well, you didn't guess the answer. What's your answer? asked the question.
Okay. That was pretty good. My answer is yes, Americans think they're taxed too much.
They do in general, but actually that has come down. We saw after the Bush tax cuts a decrease. So Americans, I think, are less concerned about the burden themselves of taxes now than they have been at a lot of previous points.
Does the whole political background of the Bush-era tax cuts register? You know, we're talking about raising taxes or resetting taxes. I mean, it's an intensely political beast.
It certainly is, and I don't think that it's highly on the radar now, but trust me, it will be in the fall in December because they expire then, and I think it will be a tremendous issue for Americans, not only if Congress and the government just lets them all expire so everybody's paying more taxes, but also the political theater.
You know what's funny, though? I mean, December just, it feels so far away. You know what I mean? Given all that we have to go through to get from here to there.
You're absolutely right. November 6th, we're all going to vote on a new president. But after that vote, all eyes are going to be on these looming deadlines at the end of the year.
Frank Newport, the editor-in-chief at Gallup. Frank, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
In San Diego, California this week, somewhere north of 100,000 people are meeting for the annual gathering known as Comic-Con. It started as a mild-mannered comic book convention 40-some-odd years ago. Over time, it's become nothing less than a pop culture phenomenon, a profitable one at that. Fans and exhibitors and media types will be there as they have always been. But after years of high-profile participation, Hollywood's presence is a bit subdued this time around. Never mind that this is the year of the Avengers and the umpteenth Batman movie, too. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has more.
Disney is presenting sneak peeks of Marvel's Iron Man 3, and Lionsgate is giving Dread 3D its first public screening at Comic-Con.
We're gonna have to go through them. Rookie, you ready?
Yeah.
You look ready.
Universal Pictures, though, apparently wasn't ready with any standout clips, according to one executive, and the studios have learned that showing off the wrong kind of material at Comic-Con can be a big mistake. Brad Ricca teaches pop culture at Case Western University. He recalls the heavy promotion Universal gave a couple of years ago to the movie Scott Pilgrim vs. the World.
These enormous banners, and they were giving away free T-shirts and showing the movie, you know, ahead of its release to anyone who wanted to see it. And the movie came out, and it didn't do well at all.
That's not to say Comic-Con fans were the reason for that box office flop. Kendall Whitehouse is director of new media at the Wharton School. From the convention floor, he told me that studios that are there are still packing Comic-Con's 6,500-seat theater with eager audiences.
This kind of fan base is something that can cut either way. If you strike a chord, it can take a film and make it do even better.
Even the studios that aren't making flashy presentations this year are still attending the convention. Again, Case Western's Brad Ricca.
All these people go to Comic-Con anyway, and they can, you know, make their deals and search for new ideas and new properties and do it without preaching to the choir, I think they realize.
Ricca says the studios have figured out the crowd attending Comic-Con is likely to see their movies anyway. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, which comes with the observation that the president and CEO of Nike, Mark Parker, is a graduate of the Pennsylvania State University. Until this morning, the daycare facility at Nike headquarters near Beaverton, Oregon, was officially called the Joe Paterno Child Development Center. After the release of the report today, though, outlining what Paterno knew about the sex abuse scandal down at Penn State, Parker said he's going to change that name. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow capped six straight losing sessions, a drop of 31 points, a quarter of 1%. The NASDAQ off 14 points, three quarters of 1%. The S&P 500 down 6 points. That's a half percent. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do
the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.